Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
You're very welcome to the Keith Andrews Show. As ever, it's available on offtheball.com in terms of YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. Joining us this week is Mr. Owen Shane. Owen, overtime for you today.
Yeah, right. Golden ticket winner is what you describe me as. That's what you describe all your guests as, apparently.
And how did you apply for this?
Well, I applied when this studio was being constructed a long, long time ago. It was one of my first ports of call when I started working for this organisation. Was apply for the Keith Andrews Show, and one day you might be successful. So here I am. I'm delighted to be here.
Good, I'm glad you joined us. Right, we have to start this week with Wes Hoolan. Landed quite nicely. Wake up this morning, bang, there it is. Wes Hoolan retires. Probably one of a few which we anticipate are certainly in that bracket. Darren Murphy a couple of weeks ago announced his retirement. There's people like Glenn Whelan, John O'Shea, John Walters. It depends how far you want to go down in terms of age groups. Aidan McGeady. Were you surprised?
Not surprised at all. Of course, though, when you pick up the paper this morning, you're like, oh, wow, okay, it's just happened. Like, you look at him at the age of 35, and if he went for another 2 years, which he would have had to do if he continued to go on, he would have been one of the oldest international players that have ever played for Ireland. So now was the time to call it. But it's just this feeling of regret, isn't it, at the end of the day? I mean, you would have seen both sides of it, seeing it from the inside, and I'm not sure, was there a sense of frustration from your side of things under Trapattoni as to the lack of Wes in the team? But certainly when you moved to the outside, looking in, you very much appreciated how frustrated people were with Wes. And even like it was Aidan Fitzmaurice who broke it in the Herald today, and like, he just, the one stat from his piece that really sticks out to me today was that he obviously has 43 caps, but since he got his first cap, Ireland have played 110 games, which is like, that is incredible. That is the stat that sums up Wes Hoolan's Ireland career.
Yeah, well, he was in a squad with Don Givens all the way back in 2002. Didn't get on when Don was caretaker manager. Gets his cap in 2008. So I actually see some similarities between our careers in terms of getting the opportunity very late. Look, I would have grievances that I didn't maybe get caps before I did. Maybe in my early 20s when I was playing regular championship level, I was captain of Wolves. I felt I should have been in and around it. That didn't happen. I had to wait until I was 28 for my first cap. Wes, very, very similar. You know, it's too easy at times just to say he should have had a lot more caps. And I know in terms of that period, that's fine. But in terms of his club career, your club career dictates to a degree how well you do at international level and get you on that pedestal. So when he was playing the League of Ireland, when he was playing at Livingston, probably didn't warrant international caps in my opinion, because the level that he's playing at isn't good enough.
I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah.
I think there's an element of the championship with this as well. Like, maybe people view it and the player in the championship is better than the player in the Premier League, but they will go, the manager will go on, you know, club experience. And they buy into that a little bit too much, potentially. And I think people realise now what a division the championship really is and the competitiveness of it all. But, like, you start to wonder, was Wes Hoolan tarred by his League of Ireland brush? Like, I don't want to kind of override the disdain that some people have had for the League of Ireland, but so he's playing in the League of Ireland, goes to the UK, and at that point then, how well do you have to play to actually outstrip the notion that, oh, you were only good enough for the League of Ireland only a couple of years ago? Because I get a sense of that with the likes of Sean Maguire now, that Seanie Maguire doesn't get the respect he deserves, but he would have been getting it had he come up through an academy system and played with that Preston North End team now. So I think there's an element of that, certainly, with Wes's career in that regard.
Well, I wasn't in Ireland when Wes was playing four shells and getting a lot of profile, and that's how he got the move to England. But I have been here to see some of Sean Maguire's development, and we spoke about this, I think it was last week or the week before, in terms of what I've seen in the League of Ireland in the last year to two. The only player that I would have picked to go into an Ireland squad would have been Sean Maguire. Now, I can't comment in terms of what Wes was doing at that time, whether it was of similar type of levels, because I looked at Sean Maguire and I just seen a player playing in the playground. He was far and above everything else that he was playing with and against in the League of Ireland. Now, I don't know about Wes.
Yeah, well, I think you've got goals with Sean Maguire. So there's a metric there straight away. It's like this guy is breaking all goal scoring records. Cork City are breaking loads of records as well. They're outstripping this unbelievable Dundalk team that everybody was watching in Europe. So suddenly that cocktail of things with Sean Maguire elevates him up to a level on a par with Championship. And that's why we had this real clamour to get Maguire in there when he was playing for Cork City.
Let's not forget as well where Wes was coming through in and around that. I think he went to Livingston 2006, got the move to Blackpool, on to Norwich. So before that, we were very much in an era where it wasn't Barcelona-type players. We've come on to this in the last, say, 10 years-ish, where diminutive players aren't pushed to one size. You know, size wasn't the be-all and end-all. And certainly the position he played when he was coming through and trying to forge a career, it was a 4-4-2 system. There was no number 10s. You played with two strikers. Now, that went against him in terms of his Ireland chances, certainly under Mr. Trapattoni, for obvious reasons, which I played in. We wanted Wes in the squad. No doubt about it.
He wanted him in the team.
Yeah. Wanted a different change of system, especially when you're playing against the better nations, where you are crying out for an additional midfielder and a player with his qualities and attributes on the ball. There's a misconception, in my opinion, about Wes in terms of that he's a luxury. I think in the last year to two, maybe at times playing a 90-minute game, because of his age, he can be seen as a luxury, but not in terms of the type of player he is. So if you look at Wes, age 28 to 32, say, he should have been in the team more often than not, because his work rate off the ball, his acuteness, his cleverness in how he wins the ball back, how he triggers the angle of approach, he instigates the press. If you look at him for club teams, Norwich in the main.
He's the trigger.
Yeah, he's the trigger. And the amount of times he forces the opposition down one side, doesn't cheaply let them come back the other way, and then your whole team shape changes behind that. Or he actually wins the ball high up, and then he has that vision to go and play the killer pass.
Yeah, it strikes me as well that, even just from his interviews and stuff, and I hate to use this word because it's such a cliche, but the honesty from Wes Hoolahan. And just, I bring that up because of what you mentioned there in terms of a pressing game. I'd imagine if there's anybody who can do it, he can do it. But also, if there's a man who can apply himself to the pressing game, it is Wes Hoolahan. If he's going to press, he's going to press well. He's going to be like Roberto Firmino without the ball. You know, he's going to do the job correctly. And I think the two strikers thing is a very good point. And I think you can, to a certain extent, hold that up and be like, fair enough with Trapp. He had his way of playing. And with the two strikers up front, there was no way Trapp was going to risk a player like him. And maybe under Trapp, you could refer to him as a luxury. Under Martin O'Neill, I think referring to him as a luxury is not a viable excuse. I think referring to him as an older player who maybe wasn't able to last 90 minutes, maybe that's fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, he played, what was it, 5.5 games out of Ireland's 12 games in total, if you add up all his minutes in the last qualification campaign. That's a pretty poor return from somebody.
He was used sparingly, wasn't he? But Martin often would change and go with a narrow four, or he would want John Walters on the right going back a couple of years and you know, to tweak the team. So it depended on the shape of the team, obviously, whereas Wes had to play in a 4-3-3. He couldn't play any of the wide positions because he would get done by modern-style fullbacks being able to go and go, where he wouldn't be able to keep up with that. But in the hustle and bustle of central midfield in that advanced area, he should have got more minutes. There's no doubt about it, he should have got more minutes. What I do think went against him, more so under the Trapp reign, Dan Martins, but I do think it played a little bit of an influence. The public clamour, media, pundits, constantly being asked about Wes. And it was probably the same going back with Andy Reid under Trapattoni and Stephen Ireland. It went against them because the whole country gets behind it, gets a little bit of a bit between the teeth, and they just push and probe. Certainly on the Trapp one, I'm not so sure how much it went against him with Martin, but I do think a little bit maybe.
Does that sort of stuff actually pervade the environment that you're in under Trapp? Because, I don't know, Trapp does strike me as a particularly arrogant man. He struck me as somebody who will say pretty honestly what he thought of people's abilities. And I would say that the last thing Giovanni Trapattoni wants to be told is what the public think. Yeah. And of what he should be doing, because I'm Giovanni Trapattoni, he will say.
What do you know?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And I think that there was a certain element of that with Wes Hoolahan, but maybe there wasn't. I'm not sure. Like, because he wouldn't have been, I suppose, in direct competition with yourself.
No.
But there is an element where your game might have been improved in the green shirt had you had Wes as a middleman between you and the strikers.
Crying out for it. Absolutely crying out for it. None more so than Euro 2012 when we were playing against Spain or Italy, when, especially against Spain, it was like you were in a nest of bees or wasps. There was that many players floating around you, and we're stuck in a four-man midfield, getting overrun, as per usual, against the better opposition. Whereas someone like Wes, I think it was his third cap, was my last cap, which was late November, November 2012 against Greece. Wes came on, I think it was half-time. I came on as a sub quite early because Glenn Whelan got injured. And straight away, that extra man, that bounce pass into midfield, to the ability to find them in those little spaces, it just makes your life so much easier. It really does.
Even, so say, for example, so in that game, Whelan's off the pitch, you're on with Houlihan. So even in the absence of Glenn Whelan, it's easier to play because you've got Wes there. It's nothing to do with the protection of Whelan is essentially a moot point then.
Yeah, well, to get Wes in the team, he has to play as the out-and-out number 10. There's different ways, obviously, you can manipulate the midfield, whereas now we have, say, a midfield of one sitter and two leg type ones in midfield, which works so well against Italy and the Euros. Whereas I can't remember, it was with James McCarthy maybe, who started that game. I came on for Glenn, so it would be maybe myself and James McCarthy, I can't entirely remember, and Wes ahead of that. And Glenn Whelan, who is someone who gets a ridiculous amount of criticism, unwarranted, and again the other way. So in terms of the public clamour for Wes and putting him on a pedestal, and which I agree to a degree, I think he's a very talented player, but I don't just go along with it because...
It's two ends of the spectrum, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Glenn Whelan, very different type of player. You can't play with three Wes Hoolands in midfield. You need people like a Glenn Whelan. You need people like me and a team to let those players, those flair players... So, for instance, could you have imagined a team back then of myself, Glenn, James, whoever it was in the two midfield positions, with Wes ahead of it, Damien Duff one side, Robbie Keane as the focal point... That forces you to play a certain way. You cannot play it direct because you have to find those players with quality in the final third of the pitch. So it changed the whole sway of a team. But obviously, it depends on what way your manager wants to set you up.
Yeah, it makes you think just even about the recent campaign and think about the potential of Arthur and McCarthy, maybe, or Myler in those two positions you mentioned there with Houlihan just ahead of them. I know Walters was missing for a long time from that, but he'd have McLean on one wing, whoever it may have been, Shane Long or Daryl Murphy up front, and then whoever was fit on the right wing. Like, that certainly seemed to me to be a team that a lot of people were saying, this is one we should be going with. And the only reason people were saying that was because they had Wes Houlihan right there in that number 10 position, which I don't think there was any question was his best role, is his best role. And we're still going to see probably a couple of more unbelievable goals with Norwich before his career is out. And it is just a feeling of regret. I don't know why I'm
saying that.
Regret.
You say that, but I go back to some of the points I was making earlier in terms of his club career dictating how much of an opportunity he gets. He couldn't realistically be thinking he should be getting caps up until probably the age of 26, 27 maybe, in and around Blackpool, season-long loan start, but then he signed in a permanent. But it was mainly Norwich when he really catapulted himself. And it was his second season at Norwich, I think it was, where he scored a lot more goals and came to prominence.
So that's when they get promoted in the first season, and then second season
Paul
in the
Lambert.
Premier League.
Yeah.
That is when he comes into the public consciousness.
And then you're thinking, yeah, fair enough. And then it depends very much on the manager who's in charge. Obviously, the last two have been Mr. Trapattoni and Martin O'Neill. What system does he fit into it? Doesn't fit in under Giovanni Trapattoni. He was reluctant to play anything else but a 4-4-2, compact and quite direct.
Yeah.
Defensively orientated. Defence first, anything else was a bonus. Rely on the magic of Damien Duff, rely on the magic and goal scoring ability of Robbie Keane. That was it, really.
Yeah.
Under Martin, slightly different. Martin was willing to tweak tactics, shape of the team. So his opportunities were more... And he did. He got a lot more caps, obviously, and the majority of his caps on the Martin. He was the third most used player on the Martin's reign, wasn't he? But in terms of minutes played, I know you've already mentioned, he will be frustrated. But in his statement this morning, he's been very grateful. And he could have stayed on and probably got past 50 caps, used in that sparing fashion. But he feels content, I think.
Maybe. I do think with international football, the stakes are higher. So you don't have another game next week to make up the 3 points or whatever in whatever a 38-game season. So I think managers are less willing to take a risk. And with a team like Ireland, that hampers Wes Hoolihan's chances of starting any games. But the thing on his club career is what I think is, look at where his position. He wants to play in a club where he is the best player in the number 10 role. Mm. Or at this current moment, he's not maybe the best number 10 at Norwich, but he'll certainly play a lot around there. Yeah. And like just in terms of playing minutes. But say take peak Wes Hoolihan. He wants to play at number 10 and start for a number 10 for any club. And you're going down through the 20 best number 10s in English football before you get to the Championship. That's only 20 players, and club football is far superior to international football at the moment, particularly when it comes to the Premier League and the money involved. So I don't think the whole kind of, oh, he's not even starting for a Championship team stick was a fair thing to beat him. Yeah.
No, I agree with that. And we've got a season ticket holder been on from Norwich City, Niall Murphy. Wes is the best player I ever watched. Absolute disgrace that he only got 43 caps. See him score at the Euros was a magical day. I was there at that stadium. Day off. Very good day. Very good night. But look, this is the affection that people have for Wes. And why there has been such a clamour. Because he is very different to generally what we produce. I think we will see a difference in the next 10 to 15 years with the coaching that has gone on and is going on at underage in terms of the way they're produced. You know, Wes was very, very different. He was a magical player.
He could improvise.
And still is. Yeah. He was clever. He was cute. And I keep going back to that point about, and I've said this time and time again, he doesn't get the credit he deserves for what he does off the ball and how hard he works. He really doesn't. And that's probably something that annoys me a little bit. The fact that he has been seen as a luxury type player.
I wonder, is the off the ball work that some of the Ireland players do, is that really conducive to an Irish system? As in the high pressing, the winning the ball back, counter-attacking, as in it has been more of a sit deep, kind of wait and see, patient sort of game. And without the ball then, I wonder, does Wes Hoolihan, is he a little bit defunct?
Yeah, it is a conundrum because he's probably one of the most clever and intelligent players I've played with in terms of the positions he picks up. And I keep going back to him in terms of that style. When you play with him, your whole team just changes. Because if I go back to when he first came in that Greece game in November 2012, we'd have had a midfielder, I've already mentioned Glenn Whelan, James McCarthy, can't remember who else was in the squad, maybe a Darren Gibson. You've got similar-ish type players, all with different attributes, but they're centre midfielders, whereas Wes is just totally different. And even what's available now, or what's been available in the last couple of years, you've mentioned Harry Arthur, you've got Brady, Hendrick, all different players. We've got no one else like Wes Hoolihan, we really don't. Mm. And on that note, we've had another tweet in off Savo. Has anyone checked on Eamon Dunphy this morning to make sure he's okay? So we know Eamon's been a big fan of his. Look, I want to move on. Overall, been a great servant to Ireland. Special, special player. And he's held very, very dearly amongst Ireland fans.
I'm even going to miss the potential of him coming off the bench. And, you know, quite often he was never used or was used too sparingly. But still, at least I had that moment of excitement when he was in the squad.
Now it's gone.
Yeah, you know, it was always the chance. It was always the hope, and it kills you, doesn't it?
I want to move on to, firstly, we'll tell you what's coming up in the show. We've got a bit of Ger O'Brien at the end of the show coming up. Steve McLaren before that. We're going to talk to him about Conte, Arsene Wenger, England days, etc. Please get in touch. If you've got any comments you want us to get stuck into, we will try our best. If not, we will get into them maybe next week. Right, on to Conte and Chelsea. Keeps lingering, keeps going on. Shouldn't really be surprised in terms of it's Chelsea Football Club. It's kind of the way they work things. But he, over the last few weeks, especially during those last two games, Bournemouth 3-0 at home, Watford 4-1 away, he looks a very frustrated figure, and it wouldn't really have surprised any of us, I suppose, if it just came up this week that Conte's left.
That's good.
Ancelotti's in till the end of the season, or there's talk of Luis Enrique, Sarri at Napoli, maybe more long-term options. But for once, they haven't hit that button, but
they're going to hit it soon.
They are, aren't they?
And I think he's accelerated the process of this happening that, okay, so a Premier League win at Chelsea, you never know how long it's going to buy you. I think Jose Mourinho is the quickest one to be sacked after a Premier League win 7 months, two seasons ago or whatever. So Conte's already kind of outdone that. But he has accelerated with what happened last year with that link to Inter Milan, and he goes to, I'm not sure did he actually go to Milan, but certainly he was on the phone to somebody in the San Siro. There was a juicy 5-year contract for him waiting at Inter, and he kind of used that as a bargaining chip with Roman Abramovich. You do not do that to Roman Abramovich. You do not call the shots when it comes to your contractual things. You take what you're given, and invariably it's a lot of money. You can hard bargain you want with Roman, but don't go off and try and hardball him with somebody else.
The stock was well and truly risen. He came in and took the Premier League by storm.
The
manner they played, the system that they played with, so different. Now we've had teams in the last 12 months trying to copy it, trying to emulate it, trying to cancel it out when they play it, playing that three at the back, going toe-to-toe. The personnel, even last season, I played with Marcus Alonso at Bolton Wanderers. If you'd have told me he was going to win the Premier League, I would have had my underpants. I swear to God. No chance. Absolutely no chance. Didn't see it. Victor Moses, right wing back.
Do me a favour.
So the way he got them going and what he did last year deserves so much credit. And he got it. And then maybe he's just had that little bit of step up and thought he's managing at a normal club.
Yeah.
And he's not.
Chelsea is like the most unnormal club you could possibly imagine. It is just strange. It's borderline schizophrenic, some of the stuff that occurs in that club. Like, it's absolutely bizarre. Like, you look at some of the players now, and I think Gary Cahill, in fairness to him, has been honest enough about it. He's like, we didn't step up at all. We weren't good enough. And that was after the Watford game. But I've got a big problem with owners making signings, because where are the players' loyalties if they've been signed by Roman Abramovich? If they see things in the media that Abramovich isn't happy with Conte, or Conte's gone off to chat to other clubs, they kind of feel knifed by Conte a little bit, because he's gone to speak to Inter Milan. Their loyalty is to the very top and not to Conte. So that might even split the camp as well, because some of them are clearly Conte players. Like, I'd imagine the likes of Moses and Alonso are very thankful to Conte for turning their careers around essentially last year. But some of them...
It's a continental model, though, and he knows what he's stepping into when he enters Stamford Bridge or enters Cobham training ground. But he has done ridiculously well. But this season just hasn't looked the same type. And you've mentioned about who signs... Like, it'll be interesting to get Steve McLaren's take on that. He would have had issues with hierarchy at football clubs. But they were after Edin Dzeko, couldn't get him because of the length of contract. That's a club decision.
Yeah, it's a poor one.
He wanted a 2.5-year deal. They were only willing to give him 18 months because, and they got Olivier Giroud on an 18-month deal, probably knowing that Conte's going to leave in the coming weeks, end of the season, and then they've only got a year left. Rather than a player left, 32 years of age or whatever they would have been, with 2 years left on the contract, where are they going to go? They're not going to go anywhere else. So it's a tricky situation, but it's run in a continental fashion. Watford are running the exact same way. The manager, and you see quite often now, manager's been appointed as the head coach. Different terminology, just coach a team. There's your players. But Conte, coming from Italy, should have been used to that.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. The Watford model is a very interesting one to point out, because they're definitely the most frequent club at just turning over a manager. And it seems that the managers are completely fine with that. Bar the latest sacking after the Everton kind of interest in the club, like, that was just a bizarre moment. But other than that, like, you go back through the managers like Jovanovic, even, or Jokanovic rather, the fella who is managing Fulham, I think, at the moment, when he got them promoted in the first place to the Premier League, there was kind of a dispute with the club, and suddenly he's out the door, and they just don't have any loyalty to the manager, and that's fine as long as you're consistent about it. And to a certain extent, I do believe Abramovich is consistent about it. And Conte would have been given a little bit more patience, because he's going to get sacked in the next couple of weeks. I'm absolutely convinced of it. I think he would have got till the end of the season on this form had he not gone off and talked to another club last summer. I think Abramovich feels that the counter-loyalty that should always be there from the bottom up hasn't existed with the Conte situation. So he hasn't done himself any favours there. But Antonio Conte is going to be completely fine. Wherever he goes, he's going to succeed, probably back to Serie A.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see where he ends up and obviously how he gets on if he's still there with Barcelona. Okay, we're going to move on. I'm delighted to say former England manager Steve McLaren joins, just back from Israel in a coaching consultancy role at Maccabi Tel Aviv. I've spent a little bit of time with him lately at games, and he is itching to get back into football.
I think it's in the blood. I think, you know, I've tried. I've had spells out of the game, and you know, if you yourself finishing playing, going into TV, if you ever go into coaching, you want to do that, managing, it's very much an up and down world, very much more downs than ups, as you know, as a player. But as a manager, it's ballooned out of all expectation. But it's kind of having a team, you know, involved when you're playing, and you're playing with a team. It's that camaraderie. It's that crossing the white line. It's that bond that you get together. And that's similar to a manager. It's about having a team, building a team, developing a team, developing individual players. And that was from 31 years old when I you know, just happened to be given an opportunity to coach the youth team and reserve teams at Oxford. Wanted to do. I've looked at other things, sports directorship, looking at punditry and things like that. But I'm a coach. I'm fascinated by the game. I love the game. Win or lose or draw, you know how frustrating it can get back on the bike, win this game, develop players, work on tactics. And I think the game is changing and evolving. And that's what I like about it. And it's about what's in front of you and what's not behind you. So there might be 60,000, there might be 500 people behind you, but it's what's in front of you, that team that we love, and the adrenaline of the games and the winning, which keep us going.
Yeah, you've spoke about the ups and downs of managerial life, coaching life. One manager who's certainly having a little bit of a dip at the moment, and you can see it visibly, is Antonio Conte. What do you make of that situation at Chelsea at the moment?
Well, it's the cycle of Chelsea, isn't it? It's bringing a manager, all the excitement, they win the league, they win a double. The second season is a nightmare for whatever reason. That might be the coach, that might be you know, the board behind, that might be the way that Chelsea is run. But I think as a Chelsea, as you go in, you have a year of success, and maybe the coach gets a lot of power and wants to start dictating a little bit more in terms of the future and going off what the club wants. And, you know, I think Conte suffered from this. I think, you know, they're self-destructing. That's what I think at the present moment. You know, and that was from the start of the season. Costa was the talisman for Chelsea last season. He was the main reason for me. He was the leader, the focal point of everything. To lose him in the manner that they did, not quietly. It was a saga that ran on and on. And Ruiz is in and out of the team. He was a mainstay last season. So he's kind of lost two players there and one player who's massive for
him. And Matic, let's not forget as well.
Sorry?
And Matic as well, let's not forget. It was crucial with that partnership with Kante
in
midfield.
Yeah, coming to that, it's crazy. I can't see that as a Kante decision. I just can't understand some of the decisions that are made at football clubs. But there again, you don't know until you're there, until you're behind the scenes that you know. But I definitely think because of that, Costa, Ruiz, Matic going to Manchester United is not the power, the control that Conte had last season. Once you lose control at a massive club like Chelsea, you can see it, you've seen it before, and you're seeing it again.
You've had to deal, Steve, with a lot of different types of chairman, chief executives. Steve Gibson at Middlesbrough, by all accounts, is as solid as they come. You've obviously had Mike Ashley at Newcastle, Mel Morris at Derby County. How difficult is it? And going back to the Conte one, you know, should he have known the path and the way it is at Chelsea? Or does he then, after that 12 months of real success, think, well, I can start shifting things around there? But is it very much dependent on the hierarchy in terms of, you know, day to day? How difficult can that be?
That's one of the challenges, and the main challenge now of managing is not just, you know, dealing with the players, dealing with the media, dealing with press, but managing upwards is absolutely key. And that's why you've got to not so much do your homework, but go into a new situation, into a new club with your eyes open. And the relationship, I always remember leaving Manchester United and asking Sir Alex for advice. And he said to me, look, you know, don't go for the club, don't go for the, you know, the size of the stadium, whatever. He says, just go for the owner, go for the chairman, go for the one who's running things, deciding things. Get a relationship with him. If you feel comfortable with him, then go with that, not anything else. And And that has been rule of thumb. And you've got to know, I went in with Steve Gibson knowing that he would give you time. He gave me 5 years. He could have sacked me two or three times easily within that period, but stuck with me. And I've gone in with my eyes open in terms of, you know, Mel Morris at Derby, and, you know, knowing that I was the seventh manager going in what, in 18 months, the seventh manager going in. I knew it was a volatile situation. And you kind of know that. So you know that. You know, this could be 3 months, this could be 3 years, this could be 10 years. It's that volatile. So I think you've got to know, you've got to have a relationship with the owner and the chairman. You've got to have an honest one, a truthful one, and you've got to go ride the blows, go with the ups and downs, but be on the same page. Once you're off that page, once you're fighting with the chairman, you're a dead man walking. And I've had that... you know, quite a few times. And I've had it the other way where my relationship, and because of the relationship with the owner, chairman, I've been given time to get over the hump, because you will get over the hump. It's a little bit like I always say, chairman, owners, everybody goes through a bad patch. And the sign of a good club, successful club, is that when you do go through that bad patch, you stand by each other and you back each other, and you see it all the way through until such time as you think, oh, this isn't working. But in quite a few instances now, people are pulling the trigger far too quickly.
Well, one club, Steve, who certainly haven't pulled the trigger quickly has been Arsenal. Now, Arsene Wenger, when he first came to England, you would have been at Manchester United as the assistant manager. I'm sure you would have come up against his teams down through the years. Very, very impressive in his early years, and had a reputation of someone who would nurture talent. Now, I've been quite critical of Arsene Wenger in recent seasons in terms of, I don't think he's interested in playing the game without the actual football save. I think he's that obsessed with his own team, but they aren't as good as they were in that era, you know, when you would have been managing against them. So what's your take on Arsenal as the club now, and Arsene Wenger in terms of where he stands right now in terms of his legacy with Arsenal?
Wow, that's a good question, and one in which I've had many friends who are Arsenal fans, and I've always said to them, when Arsene must go, be careful what you wish for. Be careful what you wish for. It's not easy managing a top club for what, 16, 18 years, however many he's done, and being successful in the top four for that amount of time. I can imagine, okay, he goes, then Arsenal will honestly could really dip unless they get it right. It's got to be right on the field. It's got to be right off the field. And I think they're structuring the club in such a way, and Arsene Wenger's led it, and he's got total control of doing it. I hated playing against Arsenal teams, because on any given day, the way that they play football, I always said 3 or 4 years ago, I ever bought a season ticket in the Premier League, that season ticket would be at Arsenal, because of the style of the football, the energy, the way that they built on possession, lost the ball, pressed, won the ball back quickly, counter-attacked, could open teams up, go around you, through you, over you. They had everything. Early days at Manchester, they had such a rock-solid defence in which it was built from. I think that's the only thing that's missing with Arsenal, and I can't understand why, is that I would think my first job going into Arsenal would be to buy defenders to make sure that... Sir Alex always used to say, last 10 games of the season, please, clean sheets. I want zero goals against, because we'll always score. And that's what he wanted. And championships, winning trophies, are built on good defence, solid defence, on clean sheets. And Arsenal, over the recent years, that's my only one criticism, is that they never look like getting a clean sheet in every game.
Do you still think that applies, though, Steve? Because I've played against them, and I'm with you in terms of feared going to the Emirates, feared going to, especially when it was Highbury, and yeah, the type of players that they have. But they were that good then. And, you know, I understand what you're saying in terms of they might take a step backwards to go forwards, but it's not like when Sir Alex left Man United, I don't think, in terms of you know, the be careful what you wish for. I just feel with Arsene, and I'm with you that in terms of friends that are Arsenal fans, they really have turning out. And I find it sad because he has changed that football club drastically in terms of the style of play. But I just, they frustrate me. They're probably one of the teams that frustrate me the most because I do think they are capable of more. But I do think in this particular window, we've seen a little bit of a power shift in terms of the signings. You know, Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan, in terms of age profile, they're not Wenger-type signings, are they, really?
No, and I think, I don't know what, I mean, I know Arsene, I've met him quite a few times over the last few years on courses, and we've had days with the leaders, who are a group that get together every so often during the year, and very, very intelligent, great philosophy on the game. You know, a real professor, as he was when he first entered. And it's like we all have to do, Keith, and you'll have to do it going from a player to a pundit. You want to go into coaching. You have to change and you have to adapt. Now, has the club adapted to the modern game? Have people overtaken? Because if you stand still in football, you know you go backwards 10 steps. You've got to keep going forward. You've got to keep adapting. You've got to keep looking at new ideas, new things, and looking at different things. And, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, Sir Alex certainly retired when he did, because he felt the game was changing, and not in terms of on the field, but in terms of off the field, adapting to the salaries and what's happening in the dressing room because of salaries. And Arsene Wenger has to adapt to that, and Arsenal have to adapt to that. But you're absolutely right. I think you know, this window we've seen a shift in terms of what's happened. Ozil re-signing, I think, has been a big shift, as you say, with the signings. And I hope in the summer that they go on, because I love Arsenal. I hate them and I love them.
I hate
playing against them. You know it. You can be run ragged for 90 minutes and lose 5 or 6 easily. And I love them, but I do think they need to get the recruitment right. I do think they need to get the defence right, because that's the platform of every team.
Hey, Steve, it's Owen here. I wanted to ask you about Gareth Southgate. Of course, you know him very well, and you know the job that he's in very well as well. So when it comes to this summer, when it comes to the World Cup, just how much scrutiny will be on Gareth Southgate in terms of a media perspective, and how well capable is he of handling that pressure?
That we won't know until the summer. Limited management experience at Middlesbrough, coming from playing. It was excellent. I was on the pro license 2 weeks ago, just observing and joining in, really. Just seeing what the modern pro license was like and get to know some young coaches in the country. And Gareth gave an excellent talk about his career, about his start, and how he wasn't prepared for what happened, how being in the 21s of England has given him that experience, certainly international level, tournament level. And I think that's one advantage that Gareth has got over a manager coming out of, say, a club. He's used to the routine of players once every 3 or 4 months organising tournaments. What he's not used to is the scrutiny of the media, and that will be exposed in the summer and leading up to the World Cup, and how he does, because at the moment he's come in and kind of come in a little bit on the blind side and not gotten an easy ride with the media, but has done very well, introduced young players, changed it a little bit of this and that. But everybody knows the true test of an England manager is at a tournament. And I was 3 tournaments with Sven. I mean, you've been on one as a player, Keith. It's poor. I can't tell, you can't explain and you can't express how huge and how big a tournament that World Cup is. And I saw that with Sven in England and the pressure. He handled it very well, was very calm. I think Gareth has got that temperament, but we won't know until it's tested.
With the benefit of time, Steve, has your perception of your own role with England and your time in that job changed over the years?
In terms of what?
In terms of potentially the way you come out of the England job, I would imagine that it was obviously an incredibly hard time for you. As the years have gone by, has your perception of that changed at all? Do you feel better about the, when you look back on things, I saw you quoted in the Times recently saying that at least you reached the summit. It doesn't matter what happened at the summit, you climbed Everest.
I know, and somebody, you know, when I was moaning about the experience in the England job, someone pointed that out to me, and people have done that quite a bit. But, you know, people, and then maybe when I retire and sit down and I've got grandchildren on my knee, maybe I will look back and go, wow, you know, that was a great time and a great opportunity and things like that. You know, I'm just disappointed that I got the opportunity and didn't stay on the top of Everest, say, on the peak, for that long. That was my one true regret. What has happened since has been tough, but I've got back on the bike. I went abroad. And I think opportunities abroad have come to me because of the England job. And therefore, my development as a coach manager has been huge, absolutely massive by going abroad, by working in Holland, by working in Germany, even by working in Israel with the Spanish staff. My knowledge, my understanding of the game, the way it's developing and changing has grown phenomenally. So I would say that I've now grown from, you know, a coach, a foreign coach, with an English mentality, and it's something which foreign coaches coming to England, I think maybe lack. And definitely when I went to Holland or Germany, all I gave them was that English mentality of really how to win games.
Steve, I obviously lived in England for a long, long time, so I would have witnessed these expectancy levels of the national team, and it beggars belief at times in terms of, you know, the criticism that's levelled. And I found it quite interesting lately when Paul Lambert got the Stoke job, there was huge surprise. There was obviously a lot of talk about our national manager, Martin O'Neill, getting the job. But when Paul Lambert got the job, everybody was very surprised. But I read a very good point that someone made, and it was basically, he's a better manager now than the one who was doing very, very well at Norwich a few years ago because of the experiences that he's been through. But it seems as if in managerial circles, as soon as you've already spoke about Steve Gibson in terms of he could have sacked you on two or three occasions, you picked the right chairman, the fit was very good. Surely now you're in a much better place because of the experience you've had with the national team, managing in Germany and Holland, experience in Israel. You're in a better place now than you were 10 years ago.
Absolutely. I knew nothing, Keith, 10 years ago. I knew nothing 10 years ago. I was flying by the seat of my pants 10 years ago and here, there and everywhere. And that's what experience brings you. I mean, what I like to see. And you're absolutely right. I feel I'm a far better manager, a far better coach, far better understanding of myself and the situation and what's required than 10, 15 years ago. And you know, the damning of English coaches and English coaches, British coaches really not getting an opportunity to manage, I feel it's one of my things that
the bugbear.
Yeah, because, you know, we are good coaches. We are good coaches, but we're not admired in Europe. But I think our coaches have, and what I like to see is the likes of Moisey, Sam Allardyce, Roy Hodgson, Pardew, Lambert. They're getting jobs now and showing, especially in terms of Roy and Sam and Pardew and Moisey, that age and experience, you need that. You need that, and I realise that. And I know now that all I need to do is to get back in and make it a good fit with a good club and a good chairman and a good project. Then you succeed. If you get a bad fit, you don't succeed. And that's the key thing, or one of the big things that I've learned and that I certainly will be looking for the next time.
Steve, just to finish, Kevin De Bruyne has come out in the last couple of weeks and he's speaking about winter breaks. As a manager who's experienced that on both sides of it in terms of when you've managed in Europe and they have the winter break. In England, we obviously, it's well documented, we don't. Looking maybe towards the World Cup and the preservation of the top players, what's your thoughts on it? Is it a sensible option, or are we just too bogged down with the whole tradition in England?
It's a must. Number one, it's a must. I experienced it in Holland, experienced it in Germany, even in Israel. We had a three week reseeding break. It's absolutely imperative because God, it was such a relief. It gave me so much. You divided the season into two halves. Your team could easily change in the second half of your mentality, the rest that you get. Going back into training camp, it's like two seasons. And you're refreshed and the players are refreshed and you're ready to go again. But I think the key thing for national teams and for England especially, I've done three tournaments with Sven. We didn't know what to do with the players at the end of the season. They looked absolutely dead on their feet. If you kept them going, they'd die. If you gave them a break at the end of the season, it was difficult to get them back to the levels again. Did you give them a little mini pre-season? Did you need to? It was so difficult. And we found that we were okay at the start of the tournament, but come the last 16, the quarterfinals, we were dead on our feet. And I remember it well in Japan 2002 against Brazil. Fantastic first half. Became in at halftime. I swear, I've never seen the players were white, exhausted, gone. We were 1-0 up and I thought, oh, we just need to hang on. Fatigue made us go down to 10 men and in the end, lost 2-1. And every tournament since, the players have looked leggy, tired, and mentally, I think the key thing is mentally, because our top players are playing Champions League till the end. Mentally, it's very difficult to get up for a major, major tournament after a long slog of a season.
Steve, really, really appreciate you taking the time, and good luck in your next venture. Look forward to seeing you, Doug, very soon.
And you. Cheers, Keith. Thank you. Mate.
Steve is an absolute gentleman. Nice to speak to him. Joining me in the studio now, though, is Ger O'Brien, Director of Coaching at St. Pat's. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
It's been a busy day today.
Yeah, not a busy day, yeah.
Just getting into the swing of things. You've had a good pre-season. I've been speaking to you a little bit behind the scenes. So pre-season's gone well. Last season, I think, probably a little bit of frustration for all concerned. But I think you're quite happy with so far how pre-season's gone, aren't you?
Yeah, it's probably been a little bit uncertain pre-season because you couldn't plan, you know, early because towards the end of the season there was still that chance of us being relegated and stuff like that. So we've kind of had to hit the ground running straight away where others were already signing back players and stuff like that. But you know, I think we'd be relatively pleased with where we are. We've got a little bit of a tighter group, but more experienced group as well, and we've signed some really good players.
In terms of, like, you speak about that and every year, and it baffles me now when it kind of players on the 10-month contracts. You see in England, obviously, players are getting 2-3-4 year deals. How frustrating and how hard is that for the role you're in now? Obviously, you work very closely with Liam and the hierarchy at St. Pat's in terms of trying to attract the players in. And then 10 months down the line, you're kind of back to square one again, trying to re-sign, trying to scout different types and trying to mould it all together in the space of, a six-week pre-season?
Yeah, it is tough. It's been the way and it's been the norm. But I do think there is teams starting to try and change that mentality. You know, Cork announced 52 weeks and it would have got a lot of exposure. And it shouldn't really get exposure because it should be just the norm in any industry. It's a job, it's a full-time job. But it shouldn't stop after a certain amount of time. I think clubs have been very clever and have held the power. But now we're seeing the flip side is that Dundalk have lost some very, very good players for nothing. They've got no transfers in for Andy Boyle, Daryl Horgan, Richie Towell, probably three of the standout performers over the last 5-6 years in the league because they haven't protected, you know,
their assets.
Mm. And now I think what we're finding, what we're trying to do is, and what we're speaking to the owner about is these kids coming through, we need to now start, you know, giving them an incentive to want to stay longer. So we've got education, you've got small contracts, stuff like that, where the clubs then can say, right, well, now we have that power, we wanted the word, that we have the power over these players now, that we need to make it a full-time environment. So it's up to us and the clubs now to be able to offer that. Mm. So when the season finishes the end of October or the first week of November, if you're looking up to get to a cup final, you're not back. You know, it's a long off season. So we want to say, right, okay, take your 3 weeks holiday, 4 weeks holiday, see you at the start of December. We'll get the planning already then. But if you don't have them guys on 52-week contracts, who in their right mind is going to come in when they could be off working for the Christmas period or something else? So on that, yeah, it is a little bit frustrating.
You've known Liam a long, long time. He was your manager at Spartan Fingal. Re-signed your Pats then as well. You've obviously got a good relationship with him. Was the coaching always at the back of your mind when you were playing in terms of that's what I want to do long term? And obviously Pat's a club that's very close to your heart. It was the ideal place for you to get into, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think the coaching side of things, I'd always have an interest in it. Even my dad coaching the local schoolboy team, I'd always go down and do sessions and stuff like that. But would have took it a lot more serious then when I knew myself that probably England or the UK was not going to be achievable. So I wanted to kind of re-educate myself. It was that or college, but I said, I actually have, you know, a good kind of, it was really kind of, it's hard to explain. If you either have it or you don't. So, and I had that as I was playing, and I didn't want that to compromise my playing because I knew that the playing years are short, and I wanted to make sure that I tried to be as successful as I possibly can without the interference of that. And then probably around 2014, end of 2014, 2015, I started picking up niggly injuries. I had the big problems with my groins. And the coaching kind of maybe, you know, became a little bit more important to me then. I probably seen longevity in it. Whereas playing, I probably knew I was coming to the end in the next 2 or 3 years, contracts-wise. I knew that they were probably going to be a little bit lessened and stuff like that. And in League of Ireland terms, you know, that can be difficult. And then I kind of spotted a niche in the market. I knew that this role was going to have to become part of the licensing of director coach, and that, you know, you're going to have certain qualifications, and there was obviously going to be a 15s, a 13s and stuff like that coming on board. So I had set my mind and spoke to the club on that, and they were more than happy to back me, which is lucky enough for me.
There has been a huge change. You would have grown up in the exact same format that I did. Schoolboy league all the way up. I always make the point that the team I was in, there was a lot of us went to England. Now, as you well know, the percentage of players that go on and make it are very, very slim. But I found back then that when players didn't get that chance in England at 15, 16, they just fell out of love of football. So this is where I think, and I've got a huge passion for the national leagues, 17s, 19s, in terms of the professionalism that it brings. I'm still to be convinced by 15s and 13s, but look, people will say I'd be sceptical anyway, but I do think it's an important change. So tell us a little bit about what you've seen at first hand over the last year or two.
I do agree with you, and I think if you roll back to when you were playing at 16, if you got the chance to go to England, great. If you didn't, it was almost like that was it.
The world, wasn't it?
You were not going to make it as a footballer. Mm. And then all of a sudden, we start seeing a trend with late developers, with the likes of Kevin Doyle gone, Keith Fahey gone, and people like that. And all of a sudden, people are realising, hold on a minute. You can still do it here. And I think that was on maybe clubs in the UK also not buying into that rat race either and saying, well, if we can leave them at home, let the League of Ireland clubs, let them get exposed to maybe first team football over there. They're coming over, mentally they're better, physically they're better, technically they're probably better as well. And the big thing about it is that we now have started to get our act together over here. You know, the Collingwood Cup was on this week up in Belfast, and
UCD,
you know, UCD obviously won it. They've been doing it for probably a couple of decades now, but we have a very strong relationship at Pats with Maynooth University. We've got kids now that when we speak to them, we say, listen, with our mum and dads, we say, where do you want to go? The kids always say England. The mum and dad say, love them to stay in an education side of things. So we say to them, great, listen, this is the plan we have now at Pats, that you can stay, play football, train, come in every day, work like and feel like you're a professional. Mm. But on the other hand, still come out with a degree at 21, 22. Yeah. And then you look at Conor O'Malley, who's only gone to Peterborough, went with a degree in his back pocket. Jake Carroll went to Huddersfield with a degree in his back pocket. So there is now proof to these parents and kids that 16 may not be the right time.
Especially because, you know, I've worked with some of the underage players and I look at them, some of the lads that are at Pats, and I look at them and I think, you're staying, you're going down the path of the 17s, 19s, you've got Brian Matter involved with the first team now. who's still only 17, they would have watched their teammates go across the water. And I could see it in them when they meet back up on the international street. I can see the envy with some of them because they want it.
Yeah.
But there's arguments to be made that Ryan Mara at St. Pat's, Aaron Bulger at Shamrock Rovers getting first team action, they're getting a better football education, never mind their actual education, than some of the lads at West Brom, West Ham, Man City.
Yeah, and I think we've all seen it firsthand as well. The kids that come home, they're coming home broke.
Yeah.
You know, mentally they're fragile. They feel like they're failures. And they used to be, and I've been at them, there used to be this thing, such and such is going away at 16, he's having a party.
Yeah.
We're celebrating going away. Yeah, like, he's done nothing, you know what I mean? And to think back now on that, it was quite strange why we done that. And now these kids are starting to realise that, yeah, I can actually get it. But that's up to us in the clubs. We need to demand a professional environment. We need to make sure that their conditioning is spot on, that their food is spot on, that their training habits are good, that they come in, that they feel like they're footballers. And for us to give that to them, it's important then that the club, the hierarchy of the club, buys into that. Because we can't look at it as a drain on resources. We need to look at it as that we're not preparing these kids to go to England, we're preparing them to come into your first team.
Mm.
And we're doing the best that we physically can with what we have on offer to do that.
But the opportunities are greater than ever, though, aren't they? In terms of this new structure, like we said, I'm still to be convinced with the tour teams and the 15s, but I may well change my mind. And that's because I would be listening to schoolboy clubs, which will obviously have their side of it. So you've linked up with Crumlin, Belvo and Cherry Orchard. Yeah. So how does that work with them? So they nurture a talent from the age of 4, 5, 6 years of age. Mm. And then in this new structure, they come to you for the under tour teams, which are launched next January. How does that work then if that kid then goes to Manchester United at 16?
Well, firstly, just going back to your point, I would agree with you on the 13s. Yeah. I'm a little bit sceptical on that myself because I don't think we've bedded in the 15s fully yet.
Fully, yeah.
Now we're only going into the first full 15 season. If we had to kick the back maybe another year with the 13s, we would have gauged a full season before making a rash decision. The other side of that is there's a lot of cost to it as well. And League of Ireland, as we all know, a lot of this stuff funnels to the first team. So we need to make sure that that's done properly. Mm-hmm. But how it would work is we would if a kid, on the example that you've given, has been at Cherry Orchard, Crumlin, or Belvedere since they're 4, that's 8 years by the time they're 12. There's a compensation agreement in place. We would compensate down. So we would say to them, instead of just that compensation years of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, we actually want to compensate you guys for the work that you're doing already. We have a figure on that, which is agreed with the clubs, to show them that we're not just taking the players. Mm. Already now you're going to get something if that kid goes away for the work that you've done. Then we've also extended the compensation agreement up as well, so it's a further 4 years up as well. So altogether, from 4 to 20, basically, is where these clubs are getting some money back. Because it is a big deal, especially to the top schoolboy clubs. They would have, you know, been under pressure to get kids away each year. So, you know, it's important that we feel that we're not just taking everything, that there is a give, as well as the relationship with, you know, coach education, CPD courses that we run for them, you know, the emerging talent program that we set up, that we take in their players on a weekly basis with Pat's coaches and stuff like that. So,
because it is important, Jay, you're obviously in a position now where you can influence that. And we would have been in that position as 14, 15 year olds, maybe going on trial. There is a duty of care to that young lad. And I think too often, it's come down to financial reasons for that player to go across. And you'll have seen it in the last few years. Certain players at Pats, they weren't ready, mature-wise, to be able to go across the water, whereas you've got some that are going to go over in the next coming months, coming years, at that little bit elder age where they are more mature. They've got their education on their belt. They've got the Leaving Cert. Even in this January alone, we've seen 9 players go from the League of Ireland over to the UK. And they're predominantly in and around 18, 19, 20 age groups, they should be able to deal with that transition in a more kind of seamless manner, shouldn't they?
That's what we're hoping for. I think that's really important. When they can do it in their own environment here, of still having mommy and daddy at home, cooking for them and stuff like that, and cleaning, and all they do is to worry about is coming in and training properly. Whereas they go away at 16, all of a sudden they're thrown into a tough environment. There's one kid who's in Sunderland that I'll be quite close with. I would have coached him as a schoolboy in other clubs, and since he's gone over, he's just had awful injuries, and even now he got back playing, he's in the 23s and stuff like that, and again last week a knee ligament injury, which is probably going to put him out for another 3 months. And mentally now is he better off there or is he better off here in this country where, you know, he has his family and friends around him that can give him that support? It's a difficult one.
Because there's no set answer, is there?
No. And
you
even
know, it's
now,
not like what's good for you isn't necessarily good for me.
No. And we have a kid now at the moment who's being offered a deal with a Premier League club. He's 16 years of age. He's due to go in June if all goes to plan. Mm. Everything's going to be agreed. Mum and dad are okay about him going. But the kid, I know by him, he's having doubts. And this is from the kid. Normally the kid is saying yes and it's mum and dad.
The other way around.
Before he goes now, we need to make sure that he's 100%. Last thing I want is him coming home next year feeling like I've failed. So it might not be right for him at this moment in time to go over.
Got to talk about Wes Hoolan.
Yeah.
Someone you've played against, I've played with, and against with. Not as much as I would have liked for obvious reasons. He's had a magnificent career, isn't he? And again, he's one of those players that is a shining light to the lads coming through and knowing that there's even more spotlight now on the League of Ireland than probably ever in terms of lads have gone over in the last few years. But he was probably one of the first, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was one of the first, definitely. And what happened with Wes was that he probably needed those extra couple of years here. Was he ready physically? Probably not. And that's why a lot of clubs overlook him. They would have looked at his size and stuff like that. But then they came and he said, well, hold on, he's doing it with the big boys here. And he went a long way, in fairness. Wes has had to put in the graft to get where to get
around the houses.
And, you know, I'm not sure what many caps did he get, 30 odd?
No, he ended up getting 43.
43 caps.
Still a magnificent tournament.
Yeah, considering that he was capped so late. You know what I mean? And, listen, it's such a pity because I know it would have been well documented by other pundits, like, you know, who wanted him in the team and stuff like that. But he fell at a time where I think the national team was in a big transition period as well. We had maybe a couple of poor campaigns and then all of a sudden we were getting a little bit of success and we were doing it in a certain way and it wasn't really that Wes way, if you know what I mean, like of getting the ball down, finding the space and stuff like that. And
I know, Joe's the one launching it.
You're chasing head there, yeah. But no, other man, and again, we've got to think back, if Martin O'Neill or, you know, whatever, Giovanni Trapattoni was club manager, they'd probably pick Wes every week.
Yeah.
International football is different. You don't get a second bite of that cherry. But listen, he'll be remembered as a top player.
Yeah, very, very fondly. We've had a couple of comments in. Jason and Sarah Keith, have we anyone coming through to play that role? Wes played for us. Jack Bourne. Jack Bourne, Liam Kelly being mentioned. Yeah. Two very talented players. Liam Kelly a little bit different for me. Jack Bourne certainly an out-and-out number 10. But as I've said all along, it's what they do at club level will determine the opportunities that they get. So Jack Bourne now will have to reinvent himself at a lower level to bounce back. But he certainly got age on his side. Don't look at it like Wes only won 43 caps. I'll always remember his craft and skill and favourite moment has to be his goal against Sweden at the Euros. Thanks a million, Wes. So look, he's very fondly thought of and rightly so. So look, that's always the time, Jay. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate you coming in. Join us next week. You can download it on the Off The Ball website. We'll be back next week at 12:30.
Off The Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.